Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ana Mateo brings us Words and Their Stories, a program which explores common English expressions and discusses their history and meaning. Later, Steve Ember brings us Making of a Nation, an ongoing series about America's history. Today's episode centers around the second half of Martin Van Buren's presidency. But first, the Higher Education Report with help from Alice Bryant.
Since their earliest days, American colleges and universities have based their study programs around what is known as the liberal arts. A liberal arts education does not require students to intensively study only one subject. Students choose a major like history or psychology for a liberal arts education. But they also take classes in other subjects that may not directly relate to their major. This is meant to give students a wider understanding of their world by showing them how different fields are connected. And it improves students' critical thinking skills by helping them look at problems in many different ways. However, in recent years, many Americans have avoided liberal arts degree programs. Parents and educators have pushed students towards fields directly related to a specific career. This includes fields in business, healthcare, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, also known as STEM fields. That is mainly due to the belief that students who graduate with business or STEM degrees are more likely to find well-paying jobs. But a new study suggests that liberal arts graduates are just as desirable to employers in the modern labor market.
Last November, the labor market research company EMSI and the Strata Network Education Research Group released a report on the skills for the workplace of the future. Researchers looked at the employment histories of over 100 million Americans, gathered from social media and professional development websites. They also examined more than 36 million job advertisements on employment websites. The report showed that 82% of liberal arts degree holders from four-year programs are employed. Those who are employed full-time made about $20,000 more per year than people with no higher education at all. And liberal arts degree holders with advanced degrees earned an additional $20,000 on average. Rob Sentz works with EMSI and helped write the report. He argues that the findings show there are plenty of well-paying jobs for liberal arts graduates. And that is because of the special skills which students learn from liberal arts programs. He says that a company may hire an engineering student immediately after college to work on a specific project, like designing a new kind of robot. But very often, engineering programs fail to teach students how to work well with others or communicate complex ideas in a simple way.
Sense says those are exactly the types of skills that are taught in a liberal arts education. The report found that employers asked for skills like leadership and communication in nearly 20% of all the job advertisements it examined. There's room for a lot of different skill areas in the economy, he told VOA. So if we push everybody to one skill area, we're going to get really unbalanced. Some people are good at this. Some people are good at that. Each of them needs to excel at what they're good at and help each other. Nicole Smith is the chief economist for the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce in Washington, D.C. She notes the report itself shows liberal arts graduates never really reach the same earnings levels as STEM graduates, even as far as 10 years into their careers. She argues that the required skills listed in job advertisements are not the best measure of what employers are seeking. That is because in the modern job market, many employers ask for more than they actually want or need when filling positions.
But Smith agrees that there is a place for liberal arts degree holders entering the job market today. She says much of the move away from liberal arts has come from the rise of artificial intelligence. Many people fear for the future of their careers as machines continue to fill more complex positions that humans once held. Smith says the companies producing these intelligent machines need help teaching them how to think more like and interact with human beings. They need help selling products, solving problems, and communicating with the public. These are skills that come from a liberal arts education. Sense and Smith agree that the biggest challenge facing liberal arts graduates is demonstrating to employers what their skills are and the value they represent. And colleges and universities need to do more to teach their students how to do so. Smith added, "We're going to need STEM students that understand at least some amount of liberal arts, and some liberal arts students who understand some amount of STEM in order for us to communicate across the board." I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
Now, from VOA Learning English, this is Words and Their Stories. American English, like all languages, has countless colorful words and expressions. We call some slang. It is not always easy to explain the history of slang expressions. Some seem to develop out of nowhere. Some do not last very long or become dated very quickly. Other expressions, however, live on for years. We use them in our day-to-day lives, usually without knowing how they began. Today, we look at one such word, and one you may be wearing right now, sneakers. Sneakers are a type of comfortable shoe. We wear them for sports and when we have to walk a lot. Many children wear them to school, and some adults wear them to work, especially if they must walk to work or ride a bike. Some say the word sneaker is slang for a tennis shoe. Others say it comes from the Old English verb sneak, meaning to move silently and with speed. If you sneak up on someone and you are wearing sneakers, they probably will not hear you. Well, unless your sneakers squeak. We all know squeaky sneakers stop silent sneaking. Say that 5 times fast. For many people, sneakers are not just for comfort. They are also fashionable. These people choose the colors and styles very carefully to make a statement about their own personal style. And they may pay a lot of money for them. So sneakers can be more than a fashion statement. They can also be a sign of wealth. Some schools in the U.S. even have rules about what sneakers students can and cannot wear. This prevents students from wearing extremely costly sneakers and avoids sneaker shaming. This is when you make fun of someone because they are wearing less costly sneakers. To some people, sneakers are a form of art. In fact, there is a museum in the American city of Boston just for sneakers. The Sneaker Museum celebrates the history of the sneaker and their cultural importance as works of art. But there are other words for these types of shoes. There are running shoes, cross trainers, and trainers. All of these fit under the same term, athletic shoes. Sometimes we just call our sneakers by their brand names. Are Chuck T's, Nike's, or Adidas. If you have an old pair of sneakers that you always wear, you might call them your beaters. Now, sneakers may not be your choice of shoe, but you must admit that they are comfortable to wear. Well, if they fit correctly, that is. Maybe that is why we say, if the shoe fits, wear it. Actually, no, that is not why we say this. We use this expression in a very strange way. Here is what it means. If someone says something bad about you, but it is true, you have to accept it. You cannot deny it. For example, a friend of yours is always late for everything. One day, he shows up to your apartment, late, of course, and says, "Can you believe it? My boss just fired me. She says I am always late." You could simply answer, "Well, if the shoe fits." You do not even need to finish. Your friend will know exactly what you mean. He is always late and now must take responsibility. He must wear the shoes of a person who is always late, so to speak. But do not be surprised if he leaves your apartment and never talks to you again. The expression, "if the shoe fits, wear it," is somewhat rude. So it is not exactly a nice thing to say, especially if someone has just lost their job. Now, there is nothing stopping you from using this expression for good behavior. Well, except for the fact that I personally have only ever heard it used for bad.
Put your sneakers on, put your sneakers on. We're going dancing all night long.
And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. I'm Ana Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about Martin Van Buren. He was sworn in as the 8th President of the United States in 1837. Not long after he took office, the United States suffered an economic depression. It lasted 6 years. The Depression was the major problem during Van Buren's presidency, but not the only problem. In foreign affairs, one of the chief problems Van Buren faced was a dispute with Britain about Canada. Canadian rebels had tried twice to end British rule over Canada. They failed both times. Rebel leaders fled to safety in the United States. There, they found it easy to get men and supplies to help them continue their struggle. The rebels built a base on a Canadian island in the Niagara River, which formed part of the border between the two countries. The rebels used an American boat to carry supplies from the American side to their base. In December 1837, Canadian soldiers crossed the Niagara River and seized the boat. One American was killed in the fight. For a while, Canadian forces and the rebels exchanged attacks. A number of American citizens assisted the rebels. President Van Buren was troubled. He declared that the wish to help others become independent was a natural feeling among Americans. But he said no American had a right to invade a friendly country. He warned that citizens who fought against the Canadian government and were captured could expect no help from the United States. Another problem between the United States and Canada at that time concerned the border along the American state of Maine. That part of the border had been in dispute ever since 1783. That was when Britain finally recognized the independence of the United States. Years later, the King of the Netherlands agreed to decide the dispute. The king said it was impossible to decide the border from the words of the peace treaty between Britain and the United States. So he proposed what he believed was a fair settlement instead. The United States would get about twice as much of the disputed area as Canada. Britain accepted the proposal, but the United States did not. The United States refused because the state of Maine would not accept it. In 1838, Britain withdrew its acceptance of the proposal. Canadians entered the disputed area. The governor of Maine sent state militia forces to the area. The soldiers drove out the Canadians and built forts. Canada, too, began to prepare for war. President Van Buren sent General Winfield Scott to Maine. Scott was able to get the governor to withdraw his forces from the disputed area. He also received guarantees that Canadian forces would not enter the area. The danger of war passed. Americans in the border area, however, were angry with President Van Buren. They believed he was weak because he did not want war. The president was losing support, not only in the Northeast. People all over the country were suffering because of the Depression. Most people believed Van Buren was responsible for their troubles because he continued the hard money policies of former President Andrew Jackson. Historian Joel Silby is an expert on Martin Van Buren. He says most historians do not think Van Buren was a strong president. However, Joel Silby says Van Buren left an important legacy.
When it comes to the political system, he was a brilliant innovator.
Van Buren organized his political party, the group that came to be known as the Democrats. In the late 18th and early 19th centuries, people who supported independent farmers and states' rights over a central government generally followed Thomas Jefferson. They called themselves Democratic Republicans, or Jeffersonian Republicans. Jeffersonian Republicans opposed the Federalist Party. They believed the Federalists wanted a strong national government, a powerful banking system, and a small elite social class. But after Thomas Jefferson died, the Jeffersonian Republicans broke into factions. They divided their support among several candidates during presidential elections, and as a result, often lost. Joel Silbey says one of the things Van Buren had learned was that above all else, when you have an ideology you want to fight for, you need unity. Van Buren organized political clubs and political leaders in New York that all supported Jefferson's ideas. He brought them together to talk about their political beliefs and choose a single candidate for their party. In the 1828 election, Van Buren had expanded this organization. His insistence on political unity had helped elect Andrew Jackson. And his system of meetings eventually became the national conventions that political parties use today to officially nominate their candidates. Van Buren also helped create the modern political campaign. In the 1820s, he noticed many state constitutions were lifting some of their voting restrictions. As a result, more people were allowed to vote. Historian Joel Silbey says Van Buren wanted to bring these new voters into his political party.
He borrowed from a couple of minor parties the notion of popular campaigns where you persuaded people through campaign rallies, speeches by prominent people, and on election day, getting them out to vote by your organization's agents.
Joel Silbey explains that these techniques to persuade and mobilize voters were new to national politics. Now they are some of the major features of political campaigns. Martin Van Buren's political tactics earned him a few nicknames. Some called him the Little Magician, because he knew how to win elections. Others called him the Sly Fox of Kinderhook. Kinderhook is the town in New York where Van Buren grew up. The term Sly Fox is not entirely positive. Joel Silbey says the nickname suggests that many people did not feel they could trust him.
Van Buren is the first person to be seen as that, a manipulator. Unfairly, I said he would do anything to win an election, and he had no real principles.
However, Joel Silbey says Van Buren did what he thought was necessary to preserve Jefferson's ideals. In the election of 1840, Van Buren ran for a second term as president. This time, his opponents used Van Buren's political skills against him. Joel Silbey says the Whigs used popular speeches and rallies to portray Van Buren as a failed president.
During his reelection campaign in 1840, crowds of Whigs would chant, "Matty Van is a used-up man," because he no longer had any power or effect on things.
The Whigs also nominated a military hero they believed the people would love. He was General William Henry Harrison. Harrison had led an attack on Indians in the Indiana Territory in 1811. Many people believed that the battle at a place called Tippecanoe was a great victory for Harrison. But Van Buren's party, the Democrats, spoke of the 67-year-old Harrison
as an old lady. They called him Granny Harrison. One Democratic newspaper said the old man did not really want to be president. It said Harrison would be happier with a $2,000 a year pension, a barrel of hard apple cider to drink, and a log cabin to live in. Hard apple cider was a popular drink among working men, and at that time, a great many farmers still lived in log cabins, houses made of rough logs. The Whigs were the party of bankers and businessmen. They saw a chance to use the Democrats' statement to their own gain. It gave them a way to present themselves as the party of the working man and the small farmer. "The statement is right," they cried. "The Whig Party is the party of hard cider and log cabins." The Whigs put up log cabins everywhere and offered free hard cider to everyone. They organized huge outdoor meetings for thousands with food and drink for all. They held parades and marched with flags, bands, and pictures of William Henry Harrison. Many campaign songs were written. These songs told of Harrison's bravery against the Indians. They told how he loved the hard and simple life of the common man, even though he was really a Virginia aristocrat. The Democrats made their own claims. They said Harrison could not read or write. They said he would not pay people the money he owed them. And they charged that Harrison even sold white men into slavery. Senator Henry Clay said the campaign was a struggle between log cabins and palaces, between hard cider and champagne. The state of Maine held elections in September of 1840. Voters in Maine elected a Whig, Edward Kent, as governor. They gave the state's electoral votes to Harrison, celebrated as the hero of Tippecanoe, and to his vice presidential candidate, John Tyler. The election results produced a new song for the Whigs, "And Have You Heard the News from Maine and What Old Maine Can Do?" She went hell-bent for Governor Kent, and Tippecanoe and Tyler, too.
"Then let them talk about hard cider, 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 and log cabins, too. It will only help to speed the ball for Tippecanoe and Tyler, too. For Tippecanoe and Tyler, too. And with them will beat little Van, 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 Van. Oh, he's a used-up man. And with them will beat little Van."
One by one, the other states voted. The election was close in the popular vote, but Harrison received 234 electoral votes compared to only 60 for Van Buren. And so William Henry Harrison became the 9th president of the United States. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.